Dr. Tillman is here at the University of Minnesota at the St. Paul campus. I became aware of some of Dr. Tillman's work a few years ago when I was looking through nitrogen research work, and his work had a little bit different tone to it. And it wasn't about the normal, well, how can we make corn grow better with more nitrogen? It was more about why we need nitrogen to help feed the world and at the same time not plow up new ground was essentially part of the message. And I thought, boy, what a chance we have here with the Agronomy Society, the Tri-Society meeting right here in Minneapolis, if we could get David Tillman to drive over here. Luckily enough, he was available. He was in town. I know you travel a bit. So we're really pleased to have you, Sue. So please come on up and share some of your ideas with us. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to an outsider. I appreciate that. So I want to talk about sort of the ecology of how ecosystems operate and the role that biological diversity may play in that. And I'm not here to tell people how to grow crops or anything else. But I just want to share some information and see whether this might strike some chords or be of interest to other people who are interested in plants and what they do for society. So we set up an experiment where we tried to answer the question this showed you. What is it that biodiversity might do? How does biodiversity affect the functioning of ecosystems, if it does? Because when we set this up, no one knew the answer. It was set up in on the Sand Plain north of the Twin Cities. It's a university 5,000-acre research site. We had it because basically farmers had farmed this land and given up. Very well-drained sandy soils were not very productive. And this was a field that when we set up this experiment, the goal of which was to plant out different numbers of species and many different random combinations such that we could ask, does the number of species interact with each other? And you might even step back further. Could you say biodiversity? Maybe we didn't look at this issue, but others have. Does the amount of genetic diversity within a field influence how productive, how stable that system might be? And to try to minimize what we thought might be a bad case of weeds interfering with our experiment, annual plants, we bolted those off the topsoil of the field to get rid of them all. So we really are dealing with sub-topsoil, very sandy soils that we planted out. And we have 152 plots, each is 9 by 9 meters. They are planted with 1, 2, 4, 8, or 16 different species. And each plot had its composition determined by random draw of species from a pool of 18 prairie perennial plants that are common plants in the Great Plains. So by having this randomization of composition at each level of diversity, we're able to ask what is the effect of the number of species independent of, if you will, averaging across many different compositions of species. Well, the first thing that was obvious, we planted it in 1994. These are long-lived prairie perennial plants. By 1996, some of them were flowering. They'd sort of become adults. So we went from little tiny plants at the end of the first year of growth to things that were sort of the size of normal prairie plants. And in 96, we had about a 70% greater production from planting 16 species than we did from planting a single species. And at 97, it went up a bit more. 98, 99, it was even more. By the year 2000, it was more. The monocultures, you can see on the left-hand side here, went up a bit. The high-diversity plots went up even more. And that trend continued so much that we wrote a paper with my colleague Peter Reich that came out in Science a couple years ago. These lines going from red to blue are from the early years of the experiment when the plants were newly just at adult size to the present time. And you can see these fields are becoming more and more and more productive through time. So not only does biodiversity, when we first had well-established perennial plants after a couple years of growth matter, but the effect of diversity is actually growing through time in this experiment. And there are two experiments here. The one I showed you a picture of is the one called BioDiv. After that was going, we added another experiment, which is a biodiversity experiment that also has elevated CO2 to mimic what might happen 50 years from now, as well as having either ambient or elevated nitrogen supply. And they all show the same effects. So here now is each plot. each individual 9x9 meter square and how productive each one of those was in the years, on average across years 2010, 2011, 2012. And you'll look at the monocultures and see that top dot. That was the species growing in replicated monocultures that was the most productive species across those 3 years. And actually the most productive species, as you might imagine, changes with weather year after year. But that was the one on average over those 3 years. Now look at 16. That's every single plot. Every single 16 species plot was more productive than the single best thing growing in monoculture. And if you look at the average monoculture versus the average 16 species plots, our high diversity plots are more than 200% more productive than the average thing in monoculture. And they're 64% more productive than any one of these 18 species growing in replicated monoculture plots. There really is a big benefit from biodiversity. We've also looked at how predictable this productivity, you can imagine what we're growing, is in essence we're growing prairie hay if you want to look at it that way. How predictable is this productivity that we have? So we've looked at year to year to year yields that we have. We've asked how predictable that is. That's here, this measurement says ecosystem stability, stability of productivity. And the high diversity plots are about 50% more predictable, less variable. You're, not only do they have more production, but you're more sure to get higher production year after year in these high diversity plots. Now, none of this is magic. Let me try to explain to you very quickly why this happens. We've spent 20 years studying why this happens. Let me give you the summary of why it happens. Plant species differ from each other. The reason the world has about 400,000 different species of vascular plants is that each of these things does something differently. It does something very well, which is sort of what allows it to live under certain conditions in nature. But there's a cost to doing something very well, and that is that adaptations which allocate resources, material to doing something well means less is allocated to doing other things. And so plants that are very good at doing one thing aren't very good at doing some other things. So we have plants that are very well adapted to low nitrogen soils. Our C4 grasses have incredibly high efficiency. They turn a gram of nitrogen into about 100 grams of dry biomass, so about 1% tissue in. That is an important feature. Among these plants, we have some species that grow during spring and may, again in the autumn. They're cool season plants, others that are more warm season plants. That's another area of differentiation. Some of these plants, especially the C4s, do have some deep roots, but most of the roots are near the surface. Other plants are much more deeply rooted. And it turns out when a shallow and a deep-rooted plant grow with each other, the shallow-rooted plant sort of forces the deep-rooted plant to put its roots even deeper. And as we had more and more species, we had much more root mass, but we also had a much greater profile, a depth profile of the soil that had dense root mass and more nutrients extracted from that. So these kind of differences among these species meant when they were growing together, we got more production than we could ever get off any one of them growing by itself. And here you can do some mathematics. I do mathematics, mathematical differential equation theory. I won't go through it all, but basically when you have species that differ like this, sort of shown here in part A of this figure, the prediction from that is as you change the number of species, that productivity goes up and up and up. And another prediction is that stability goes up. More diverse systems are predicted by mathematics. This is one of four different models which looks at how species differ, how those differences let species compete and still coexist, and what that implies logically. And the logic implication is for all of these models, the greater number of species, greater diversity leads to both greater productivity and to greater stability, greater reliability year after year of the yields that you get. And here's one of the reasons this happens. This is the level of nitrate extractable from soil cores pulled out in these plots. And this is just one point in time, but the same thing happens over and over again. More diverse plots extract more nitrate. There's much greater root mass, so they're taking up more nitrate. The amount of nitrate left in the soil, unextracted, is what is shown here. The remainders, the unconsumed nutrient, the majority of nutrient, a much larger proportion, is consumed in these high diversity plots throughout the growing season and throughout the depth profile. So they get more nutrient from the soil because of that. And there's a feedback effect. When these plants, we remove all the above ground biomass, so that's not a feedback effect, but the fine roots that are in the soil are shed every year, adding organic matter to the soil. The more root mass we have in the soil, as we have more and more root mass at higher and higher diversity, but with more root mass, we have more organic matter input to the soil, and that organic matter builds up. And this shows you, through time, what is happening to soil carbon. Carbon's on the y-axis. One are monocultures, then two species, 4, 8, and 16. We have much more carbon being stored, much more carbon building up in the soils of high diversity plots than we do of low diversity plots. And the same thing is true for nitrogen. I didn't put the numbers over there, but they literally go 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 from the bottom to the top in terms of the nitrogen content of these soils and how it's been changing through time in this biodiversity experiment. So these plots are not only more productive, but why they actually become more and more productive through time is this feedback effect of these perennials on soil carbon and nitrogen stores. More carbon and nitrogen stored in these richer soils leads to greater fertility of those soils. We've actually just pulled soils out, put them in pots in a greenhouse, grown test species, and the more diverse soils, after 15 years of having high diversities on them, are much more productive than the soils with low diversity crops. You can take all those data, because we measure carbon and nitrogen in these plots through time, in each of these 150 some plots through time. We know what the diversity level was. We know what the soil carbon and nitrogen was at the start. And from those, you can fit what's called the differential equation to these models, and you can use that to predict what's going to happen in the long term. And what this model says is that in low diversity plots, we don't get, like here it says one species on the left-hand side there. On the average monoculture, soil carbon is going to go from what it started at to being about 43 tons of carbon per hectare. In high diversity plots, it's going to go to about 78 tons of carbon organic matter per hectare after 200 or so years. These will finally level off. So these two things are leading to increases in carbon as well as nitrogen. The same graphs happen for nitrogen. So there's a lot more in the long term that's going to happen as far as storage of carbon and nitrogen and fertility of the soil because of growing these high diversity mixtures together. Now, what else makes more diverse plots more productive? One thing is disease. Disease incidence is lower when there's higher plant diversity. Now, that's no real surprise. Most plant diseases are species specific. The more species there are, the further an individual that is infected is away from other individuals of that same species that could be infected. So this shows this disease incidence and how it falls as you increase diversity. But the same logic, I would assert, applies to crops. If you have crop genetic diversity in terms of susceptibility to different types of a given pathogen, greater genetic diversity that way should, in theory, decrease disease incidence. Livestock genetics, if I had a million chickens in a building, I wouldn't want them to be genetically identical to each other myself. It seems a bit too risky. And then on the last stage, there's been a lot of work done, especially in China, on the effects of intercropping on yields and intercropping and disease incidence. For instance, a classic study came out about a decade ago in Nature showed that two different varieties of rice grown in alternative rows, because they had different disease susceptibilities, got rid of the need to apply a fungicide that was attacking one of the rice species. So diversity at that level can also be used, although there haven't been really detailed studies on the ecological side of the diversity within a species versus diversity among species. Now, another reason these high diversity mixtures are more productive, and this is not as important as the soil, is that the whole insect community that lives in these grasslands changes as diversity is higher. So this is looking at the ratio of the number of predator insects and parasitoid insects divided by the number of herbivore insects. The herbivores are the ones that eat the plants. And this ratio changed quite a bit, going from monocultures to high diversity plots. Basically, in monoculture, you have a high abundance of an herbivorous insect that is specialized on whatever that plant species is. And as you go out to higher and higher diversity plots, those herbivores are much less common, and you have instead predators and parasitoids that are attacking a wide array of these insects. So the whole community composition changes with diversity. Everything else I've told you, I know why. I really don't know why this one happens. This is like, and then a miracle happens in the old Greek plays or whatever. I don't know why it happens. I don't know entomology at all. I just was amazed with one of my postdocs who did his work as to what he found. Now, am I talking too quickly? If I'm done soon, how much time do I have?
I think we're doing okay. Yeah.
Good.
A few more minutes.
Okay, perfect then. So you might ask, how important is biodiversity? When we began this work in 1994, planning out these plots, If you had asked ecologists, does diversity matter? Would changes in diversity likely affect the functioning of ecosystems? Probably 3/4 would have told you no. Because at that time, people thought that certain species had important traits, and it was the trait of the dominant species that determined how an ecosystem worked. And so almost no one thought diversity actually mattered. And when we set this up, if you would ask an ecologist, well, what's going to determine how productive a grassland is? The list of things they would have talked about would be rainfall, water here, drought, another water thing. They wouldn't have said CO2, but we have data on it. They would have said herbivores had a big effect. They would definitely say soil nitrogen content would have a big impact, and that fire would have a big impact. Well, we have experiments manipulating all these things at this research site. We have long-term fire, herbivory, CO2, drought, water, nitrogen experiments, as well as biodiversity experiments. And you can look at the effect size. Going from 1 to 16 species has a bigger effect and is more significant and a more significantly larger effect than anything else that we've ever manipulated out at Cedar Creek. Adding 95 kilograms of N per hectare doesn't lead to that big of a change in productivity that we get from going from a monoculture to 16 species. And then you see 2 to 16, 4 to 16, and so on. Diversity really has unsuspectedly large impacts on how ecosystems operate. Now, one reason, and this really is something that I should have thought of, but I wasn't that smart. One of my postdocs and now collaborator, Forrest Isbell, figured this out. One reason that adding nitrogen doesn't have as large an effect as you might imagine, especially in the longer term, is this. When you add nitrogen or any limiting resource to a plant community, the species that use that resource most efficiently lose out in competition to ones that are inefficient at that resource but are efficient at whatever you did not add. Because what you didn't add is what's now more limiting. So when you add nitrogen, you lose the C4 grasses and other plants that are very efficient at turning that nitrogen into biomass. And they're replaced by things like quackgrass, which is very inefficient. You probably see it in the cornfields if you're a farmer. Not anymore, I guess, but people used to. So this graph on the left-hand side shows where things were in terms of how productive these different experiment grassland native prairie plot was in 1982 when we started fertilizing it. That's the far away from the end of the arrow, not the tip. And that shows productivity with adding different rates of nitrogen from the black line the least to the red line the most. And how many species there were per square meter in this native prairie grassland. And what happened through time was when more nitrogen was added, more species were lost. And as species were lost, productivity, you can see, declined. Those arrows are all going down. So this loss of diversity caused by adding N actually caused a very great loss in productivity because of that loss of diversity. And in fact, if you look at this second figure, the part on the right, there are two lines. The dark upper line is a graph showing you the relationship between the number of species lost and how that impacted productivity. Maybe it's a pasture or a hayfield. As you fertilize it, you lose diversity. As you lose diversity, you lose a lot of productivity because you're losing these plants that are very efficient at using it. And that's the curve that we see there, that black upper line. The dotted line below, sort of the shady dotted line, is the data I already showed you for the biodiversity experiment where we have random loss of species, not selective loss. When you add a nutrient like nitrogen, you're getting selective loss of the most efficient use of that resource, and that causes a much greater decline in productivity than you see in a random biodiversity experiment where you randomize the loss of species. Finally, we looked at the same broad range of experiments and asked what determines how stable they are. So when you add CO2, or you change fire, or you add an herbivore, or you water, or there's a drought, or you add nitrogen, what determines how stable that is? And if you look on the right-hand side, that's a graph on a logarithmic scale of the number of species that were lost and the diversity that is lost from these various treatments. And on the other graph, it shows what's happened to stability. And what you can see, basically, these two data sets have about the same shape. As diversity is lost, for whatever the reason, stability is decreased. So, in fact, the slopes for these are the same across all of these experiments, which says that it looks like the major thing that is determining how stable these ecosystems are is how many species there are in them. So I want to step back now and sort of summarize this. Maybe I'm about to run out of time, but Jim, smile. No. Oh, there's a number there. I thought you were scoring me. I'm going down. It's really getting worse and worse. I hope one's the high best number here. So what I want to say, and I'm not here to tell you how this is going to apply to the questions that you ask, because if I knew that answer, I would tell you right now, and I don't know that answer, but I think there's some lessons to be learned from this. First of all, in the emergence of life on Earth, species have always faced trade-offs. To get better at doing one thing, they did something else not so well. And it's those trade-offs which make species specialists, and when species are specialists and they differ in what they do, is what provides the reason that when there are more species present in a system, that system functions better. Basically, in essence, a group of highly specialized species leads to a much more productive and a much more stable system than any one generalist species can lead to. So thank you for listening to this.